today. This is August 3rd, 2004. We're at Charlie's home in La Grande. And the first question I have would be, what incidents have you run into related to your legal practice, which is goes from 1939 to 79 in La Grande?
Well, I came here in 1939. I didn't really know anybody here. All I knew is that I liked the country. I had been exposed to Eastern Oregon when I worked during summer vacations when I was in the university.
University of?
It's not a secret. It's Willamette University.
Okay.
And I had come over here on work cruise for the highway department, several places, and I loved the Eastern Oregon country. So when I had an opportunity to come up here and somebody brought me up, I came here and I have never left, except to take trips to go hunting or fishing or to go to California in the spring when the grass is green down there and before it starts here. All right.
Okay, you were going to give me a first case that was interesting.
That is true. So, I know this is kind of ridiculous, and I told this before on another tape, but anyway, a man came to see me one day. I didn't have anything to do. All I had was a typewriter, an old Underwood. His name was James Moore, and he was the manager of the Eastern Oregon, not Eastern Oregon, the Grand Ronde Hospital. And he had with him a thick book. And this book had, the only thing it had in it was a whole series of partially or totally unpaid bills. This was near the end of the Depression, and people hadn't been able to pay their hospital bills. So he wanted me to see if I could collect them on a fee basis. So much for whatever I was able to collect. So I undertook that, and that's what I did for a while.
What was the name of the hospital?
Grand Ronde Hospital.
It was Grand Ronde?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you remember the name of the man who came to you?
James Moore.
Okay. Go ahead.
He was the manager. He's a good man, and a quiet man, a good man. Anyway, not long after that, the Japanese jumped on us at Pearl Harbor, and we started gathering ourselves together in the United States to fight a war. And one thing they did here in La Grande was to take everybody out of the local college and replace them with a group of young men they were going to train for a certain military duty. And we had a whole bunch of them. And one night, in the dark, one of these young men that was here as a part of the military preparation was walking down the road just outside of La Grande. And a car hit him and killed him. Well, there were three people in the car, a young woman and two men. And the district attorney and the other law enforcement people thought that they could make a case and that one of these men was the driver of the car, and therefore they charged him with negligent homicide.
Do you remember any of the names of these people?
I certainly do. The name of the one they charged was Johnny Jennings Lewis. L-E-W-I-S. An added piece of information about Mr. Lewis, and one of the reasons they charged him rather than the other two, was the fact that he was a five-time felony loser. He had been convicted five separate times before this incident. He had been convicted of felonies and served time in a penitentiary someplace.
Were these felonies in the LeGrand area?
No,
in Union County?
Someplace else.
Okay.
I don't know where they were.
Do you remember the name of the district attorney?
Yeah, it was probably Carl Helm Sr. or I can't think of the other name.
Okay, let's go ahead then.
Anyhow, this Lewis didn't have any assets. He couldn't pay for an attorney, and it was the requirement by constitutional mandate, U.S. Supreme Court, that a person charged with offenses of one kind or another had to be provided with a counsel, attorney, so he could make his defense. Well, in those days, they didn't have a contract public defender. The judge would pick somebody out of the attorneys and say, you are going to be the counsel for this man. So the judge at that time was R.J. Green. R.J. Green.
Does that have an E on the end?
No.
Okay.
And in his infinite wisdom, he appointed me to defend Mr. Lewis. Now, I really never tried a case. My experience had been very limited. And I have thought since then, looking back, and I did not think this at the time, but looking back over the years and with other things that have happened here and there in the United States, I came to the conclusion that Judge Green made a mistake when he appointed me to represent Mr. Lewis.
This was your first court case?
One of the first.
One of the first.
I don't remember any others.
The year was 1939 or 1940?
Well, it was right. You see, this Japanese thing happened in 41.
Okay.
And it was right after that, very shortly after that, that they brought these young men here and to train them at the college, and one of them was killed. So the judge appointed me, and as I have said, looking back and noticing how the criminal justice system works as well as I could from my own experience and reading the newspapers and stuff, I came to the conclusion that my Judge Green, had made a mistake. It didn't turn out that way. I defended the man. He was found not guilty. And as a matter of fact, the jury that sat in that case must have come to some conclusion about me. And I don't hesitate at all to say that purely as a matter of guesswork, I, looking back, have come to the conclusion that that case and that jury was the foundation of my later practice. and my reputation.
Okay.
See, reputation hangs on what you do and what other people perceive as what you do. And that jury saw what looked like a real, real tough case. And I was defending a man who was found not guilty.
Do you remember the name of the man who was killed?
No, I never knew it. Oh, I must have known it. But no, I do not know.
But he was here.
He was going to attending the college in a military preparatory study.
What was the name of the college at that time?
Eastern Oregon College.
Eastern Oregon
College. Now called a university, but it was called Eastern Oregon College at that time. So, after the trial was over, I had a little talk with Mr. Lewis. And as young as I was, and inexperienced, I gave him some advice. And I said, Johnny, you are not very popular here, and you're lucky this time. I suggest that you go someplace else and where you're not known and where you'd have a little better chance to get accepted by various communities. He did not take my advice.
Did he get in further trouble that you know
of? He did. I don't know what it was, but I did not try to follow it because I was all through with what the judge had asked me to do. So anyway, he was in jail, charged with something. I don't know what it was. I did not defend him. But he called me on the telephone from the jail, and he told me that he had a car he wanted to sell. And he offered to sell it to me. He had an old Oldsmobile, and he wanted $150 for it. I wanted the car. I didn't have a car. I had no wheels, no transportation. When I came here, I didn't have any. And when this was all over, I still didn't have any. So he wanted $150, and I didn't have it. But I had made friends with Mr. M.J. Goss, G-O-S-S, who was the proprietor and owner of an automobile dealership here. And Mr. Goss had been kind to me a little while before when I needed a truck to move some personal belongings from one house to another, rented houses that I occupied with my wife. I talked to MJ, and he offered and did lend me $150 to buy that car. Now, the odd thing about this was that before this happened, when Mr. Goss had befriended me with the loan of a truck, I had made a promise to myself that when I bought a car, I would do two things. I would buy it from Mr. Goss, and I would pay cash. So the upshot of this deal with Johnny Lewis was that I broke my promise. I didn't pay cash, and I got the money from Goss. I borrowed the money. I made another promise. I reiterated or re-promised myself that henceforth I would deal only with Mr. Goss and I would pay cash. Anyway, I acquired the car and I had it for a while. But from that day forth, I paid cash for every single vehicle I bought, and there were a lot of them. And I bought almost every one of them from Goss. One or two I bought from his son, who had a separate business at that time. And one I bought from another dealer during war when we couldn't get cars from anybody else. I couldn't get a car from Mr. Goss, and I needed one. So I bought one.
This was during the war years.
Yes.
It was hard to get vehicles.
Yes, it was definitely. They just shut out making cars and started making tanks and guns, cannons, airplanes. There's a story about that.
Was that affecting Union County? The war effort?
Well, it sure did. Before it was all over, they took an awful lot of people out of Union County, and I was one of them. By this time, I still had the wife, the original, and I had two kids, little boys. And then they drafted a lot of us, and I was one of them. I didn't volunteer. I could have wiggled out of it. Some of my fellow lawyers did. In fact, every one of them did except one. And my friend Carl Helm, who was another lawyer here, volunteered for the Navy. And he served in a corvette, which is a small battleship, and he prowled with his little battleship throughout the North Atlantic.
Did he survive the war?
Yes, he did.
Okay, and you did?
Yes.
But you don't know of other lawyers who joined up or went along with the draft?
Well, I do know, but I don't want to talk about too many of them. It's bad enough for me to go about bragging about me. And I do that. Anyway,
okay.
I want to tell you about Carl Helm. Carl was another lawyer. He was a very good friend of mine. I deeply respected him. I fought him in court on both sides. He was on one side and I was on the other in quite a few cases in later years. But I couldn't forget that Carl commanded a little battleship, a corvette, in the North Atlantic when that ocean was just crawling with stuff. German stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost death to go out in that sea, but he did.
Okay. The other people who served from Union County?
Oh, a lot of them.
About how many people came here to the college for training?
I'd say several hundred, but I became friends with one or two of them. They were nice guys, and I took one of them with me, and I, by this time, had acquired things that I have had in my life ever since. Rifles, because I have done a lot of shooting. a lot of hunting. So this young man and I took one of my rifles and some of the ammunition that he got through his military service there at the college. And we went up the road here a ways to a place just the other side of where, well, it's quite close to that place where they had the jail for the young guys. Just
well, the present day.
Yeah, it's there.
Okay, you were hunting out there.
Huh?
You were hunting out
no,
in that area.
No, we just went out there to shoot.
To shoot.
Target.
Okay.
Then not to hunt. And he had some ammunition. It was, it fit the rifle that I had. But it was, it was designed as it was called tracer ammunition. When you fired it, the bullet took fire, and you'd see a trail of light from the bullet.
Mm-hmm.
You know about this?
Yeah.
Okay. We had some tracer ammunition. We got down to where we had one shot left, and we were going to shoot it. And I shot it myself. And there was a stump up on the other side of the river, quite a bit higher than the surface where we were, and higher than the river. And I shot at that stump. And this damn tracer set the stump on fire. And from then on, for a couple hours, my friend and I were busy putting that fire out. We had to get up that steep slope and eventually stop that fire out because we didn't have any tools. We just had bare feet with shoes on.
So
it was stupid.
Okay.
See?
I'd like to get back to your legal practice. After this first case, you said that made your reputation.
Well,
what happened to your practice?
I'm just guessing. I don't know that it did, but it's inevitable. When you take a tough case and win it, and you got 12 jurors, they're watching you do it. There's bound to be a residual information with the 12 people.
Okay.
And anybody else that's in the courtroom,
what
like
is
a judge.
What are some of the, and this was R.J. Green was the
yes.
judge. Okay, what were some of the other cases you ran into following this?
Oh, well, well, R.J. Practiced law for 18 years, and along the way, we became very good friends, and evidently he had confidence in me, because when he had a real tough case, he hired me, or retained me, that's a better word, to assist with two other lawyers in his case, having to do with very valuable timberland in Wallowa County. So I made a tape here before with Mr. Venn, and it's on that tape what I did then. And briefly, I had attended a continuing education program put on by the Bar Association just before this incident I'm about to describe.
Okay.
And the subject was reformation of instruments. That merely means changing a deed, a contract, or something to make it fit what may have been or should have been the intention of the original signers, signatories. So when I came back from that continuing educational program put on by the Bar Association in Eugene, Oregon, by the way, I was in my office, and the two other lawyers that were with me on the case, Alex Byler from Byler, B-Y-L-E-R,
okay,
and Robert Christman, C-H-R-I-S-M-A-N. All three of us were in our office, and we had made a joint decision that the pleading that had been prepared, and I don't recall who had prepared it, it was one of the other lawyers, that wasn't adequate to present the case that we had to show to the trier of fact. So I redrafted the complaint for Judge Green to submit his contention. And we went to trial on the document that I had prepared. We tried it in Wallowa County, and the judge was Lyle Wolf, L-Y-L-E, Wolf, W-O-L-F. Maybe there were two F's, but one's enough.
Okay, what was the gist of the case?
The gist of the case was that he didn't intend to include the timber on the land that he sold.
Oh, okay. He had excluded the timber rights.
He attempted to, but the deed that he signed was not clear, indefinite, and he was still to lose a hell of a lot of valuable timber and money if it went with the land. See? Got it?
Mm-hmm.
All right. We tried the case before Judge Wolf up there. We won, and then the other side appealed it. And we won there, too. We won in both courts. And that was the end of it. Judge Green paid me. He paid another lawyer, Mr. Christman, and later, it was one of the reasons that people talked about, and lawyers and judges, was their knowledge gained over the years about Judge Green. Now, there was nothing wrong about it, and nothing embarrassing. It was just that everybody knew that he cherished every dollar that he had, because he worked for every single one of them. And taking money away from R.J. Green was almost impossible. You had to be lucky, and they weren't lucky, and we were lucky. Anyways, now that's just one thing. Later, R.J. died, and before he died, he asked me to handle his estate, and I did, and that's the end of that.
Were there any issues related to Judge Green's estate that were interesting?
Well, there was one thing. R.J. had a, you might say, a business practice of lending money to people that he knew that lived here in the Grand Ronde Valley. He'd lend money on notes and mortgages and this and that. He had done this for a long time. And when he died, there were outstanding a number of these loans. His wife's name was Edna, and Judge Green made a mistake. It's the only mistake I know of that he made in his life and practice. But he assumed that his wife would be able to handle these accounts and collect them and so forth. She couldn't. It was beyond her. And I couldn't either. But I arranged for some organization or some individual to take over these accounts and collect them. That was done, and that worked out just fine.
Was this a common practice during this time? You're talking about the 1940s, I think, here in Union County.
Yeah.
Was loaning money, individuals loaning money, a common practice?
Oh, yes.
Were there banks here that also loaned money?
Oh, yes. They were in competition.
They were in competition.
No doubt about it. Yeah. R.J. Green had operated at least two bands of
tape one with Charlie Cater on August 4th, 2004. We're talking about the bands of sheep that R.J. Green had.
Well, because R.J. had sheep, he was disqualified in a way, and personally disqualified himself to try the case that came up that was perhaps the most outstanding trial that we've ever had in Union County. This had to do with the fact that this was the center of a large sheep industry. There were a number of people and corporations and businesses that owned bands of sheep, and they wintered them in what they called the sand, which is out by Butter Creek in western northeastern Oregon. One of the
is that in Union County? Are you talking about?
No, it is not Union County.
Okay.
No, I don't know what county it is, but it's over there. So anyway, one of these owners of the several bands of sheep was a man named Tom Boylan. Well, Tom had a bad accident. He was driving between here and Pendleton, which he had to do in managing his business many times. So he, in the dark, at night, he hit a horse in the road. Probably killed the horse, but it damaged Tom Boylan. He got a brain injury out of it. The result of Tom Boylan was that his business broke up. He couldn't manage it anymore. And then everybody that had contracts on sheep, or his sheep, contracts to buy sheep, mortgages, and so forth and so on, they all gathered around, and we had a trial in the Union County Courthouse. Because R.J. Green had had then or had had sheep interests, he couldn't sit to try that case.
Do you remember the year of this trial?
The year? Let's see. No, I don't.
Do you remember the decade or close to the year?
Sure. It was in the ten or 12 years after I got here.
So in the late 40s or early 50s?
I suppose somewhere in there.
Okay. Now go ahead with the trial and his recusal.
Well, in order to sort out the various claims, we ended up in a complicated case in the Union County Courthouse. Now, this is perhaps the most astonishing piece of history that you're going to hear. In this trial, we had a judge from Bend. I have his name in the back of my head pretty good. But we had 19 lawyers in that courtroom right here trying to sort out this various problem. And there was a spinoff in another court over in the Federal District Court in Pendleton, because the Oregon representative of the Attorney General's office, a man named Dillard, conceived the brilliant idea that when Tom Boylan sold sheep, they were covered by mortgage. It was a violation of federal law. He was wrong, because whenever anybody in the sheep business mortgages sheep, including lambs, everybody knows, everybody that knew except Dillard in Pendleton, everybody knows that the sheep man is going to sell those sheep when it's time. So there is no restriction on the sale of mortgage sheep, because they have to be sold. You can't keep them over. So anyway, one of the lawyers was a man named Henry Hess, and he asked me to join him in the case, and I did, and I spent some of my time in Pendleton auditing the proceeding in the Federal District Court. And some of the time I spent in the courthouse here, and some I spent in the library looking at the books and the law. Well, then a strange thing happened. We were in that trial the first time for 6 weeks. And then the lawyers and the judge got together and agreed to have a recess so that the lawyers could ask and receive a transcript of some of the testimony in order to be able to put together their contentions and arguments and so forth. So we laid off for a while. I don't know how long. Several weeks. In the meantime, the lawyers had asked the court reporter to prepare partial transcript of the testimony. When the recess was over, and we were all back there in the courtroom, and we looked around, and there was no court reporter. Absolutely no court reporter. So there was a chattering and a discussion that sounded like, I suppose, like a bunch of chickens talking about things, what to do. Well, the lawyers got together and they appointed two people to see if they could find the court reporter. And they appointed me and a man from Baker by the name of Blaine Halleck. Blaine Halleck was a lawyer of many years standing in Baker, and I was a new lawyer from LeGrand. So he took out, he and I, and I thought I knew where the court reporter lived. And we went there and hammered on the door and couldn't raise him, and went around back of the house and hammered on the house again. And this time we finally heard a weak voice inside. So we went inside and we found the court reporter. And he was in bad shape. Obviously, he was an alcoholic, and he had got drunk, and he said that he destroyed his notes, so there wasn't any notes that he could use to make a transcript. We went back to the courtroom, reported to the judge and the lawyers, and then what to do.
Do you remember the court reporter's name?
Do you really want to hear that?
Yes.
Yes, I know. His name was Ralph Smith. And I couldn't bring myself to criticize him too much. He was the victim of a terrible, terrible habit. And he's not the only one that has fallen into that trap.
Okay.
And so I am not inclined to be critical. In the end, it didn't really hurt anybody, I think. So we got together and we hired another court reporter. Her name was Annetta Johnson. Her brother, until very recently, was a professor at the college here.
Do you remember his name?
His last name was Johnson.
Johnson.
Right now, I can't think of his first name.
Okay. What did he teach?
I don't know that.
Okay. Let's go ahead.
But he was a good man. I've seen him many times. And I knew his sister very well, Lee Johnson. All right. So, we tried carry on, but we couldn't. And it finally ended up that we settled the case, the whole thing, all of it, except the federal district case, which just fell flat when all the lawyers started congregating and telling the Attorney General's representative that he just didn't understand the sheep business. So, the Culpin Sons Sheep Company, Barney Horn, and possibly others paid off the fee that was claimed by Henry Hess. And Henry divided that fee with me. I don't know how much it was, but I owed to a lady in Portland that had staked me for an education by paying my, or offering to pay my tuition. I owed her $1,105 after 6 years in Willamette University. Sounds like not an awful lot of money. But I had the money when Henry paid me, and I paid her. And by that time, I didn't owe anybody anything. So that was the end of that case.
What do you know about the further career of R.J. Green?
Well, he continued to be circuit judge, and we continued to be friends, but it was a little bit different than the first time he appointed me. He appointed me to represent Johnny Lewis out of ignorance about whether I could do the job or not. Later, he appointed me when somebody needed an experienced lawyer in a tough case. And then he appointed me. And I do not remember the cases. All I remember is what I just said. Well, anyway, I told you about Mr. Eaton, and you read the letter from Willamette. Do you want to go over that again?
Which one was this?
He's the one that paid for the Eaton Hall at Willamette University.
Oh, okay. Let's go over that.
But well, you've got it in your hand there, I think.
Oh, I have the one related to Pierce Library.
That's not it. Just hold on. I've got it right here. Here it is. Here's the whole story right here.
Okay, this concerns Abel Eaton?
Eaton Hall in Willamette University.
And Mr. Eaton lived in Union County?
Union.
In Union, okay.
Yeah. He had a wool processing plant there.
Okay, and it relates to after his death at the age of 74, his wife was short of funds.
Well, he beggared her in his disposition of his estate. Now, people do things like this, sometimes through thoughtlessness, sometimes by accident, but that's the result here. She didn't have it. The university made good.
This is in August 30th, 1979, is the letter you have here.
That's the date on that letter. When I went to Willamette University, There were only four buildings on the campus. There was one that was devoted to music. One was Waller Hall, and the other one was a science building. And then there was Eaton Hall. Eaton Hall was the biggest building. It had a whole lot of classrooms in it. Hardly any of the other buildings had any noticeable classrooms in them. But Eaton provided the classrooms that were used when I went there.
Okay. According to the letter, Mr. Eaton died in January 15th, 1917, and about $100,000 from his estate went to the endowment for the university. And then it was during the Depression that his wife fell on hard times.
Yeah.
Okay, did you have any... Well, this would have been too late. So your connection with this was that you went to Willamette University.
If there's a connection, that's it. Because I had classes in those classrooms that Mr. Eaton provided.
Okay.
Yes.
From here. Do you know if he was a native to Union County?
I have no idea. The name Eaton tells me, and his business tells me, he was Scotch. Now, one might say, well, why did he engage in the wool business when there are all these trees out there? Because he was Scotch. They didn't have a lot of trees in Scotland. They had sheep.
Okay, so he brought his... Did he come from Scotland?
I don't have any idea.
You don't know. Okay.
No. But he seemed to be seriously interested in education.
Okay, in the...
Which is not uncommon for Scotch.
Yeah, the endowment of... A total of $100,000 is a rather large endowment for that period of time.
Especially because dollars are different than they are now.
Okay. Who else have you dealt with? You've had some dealings with some of the black members of the population here.
Oh, yeah. Lucky Trice was a friend of mine. I may have done some little work for him, but I don't remember it. But my wife took care of some of their tax returns, income tax returns.
What did Lucky Trice do? What did he work at?
Oh, for a while I know he had a hat shop. It used to be people wore hats and they would have to have maintained, blocked. You know about blocking? Not likely.
Blocking hats?
Yeah.
I've heard of it. I don't know it directly.
Yeah, all right. That's one thing he did. Another thing he did is he played poker, and very well, too. I don't know what all else he did. I really don't.
Let's explore the poker. Did you play with him yourself? And how much did you know about his poker playing?
I never played poker with anybody. I did some gambling when I was in the Army, not poker. And I piled the money. and I brought it all home, every dime. I sent it home. She knows me. She knows me damn well. When they talk about how how tight Judge Green was, their next word is Charlie Cater.
Okay, let's get back to Mr. Trice.
Who?
What's his name? Trice?
Oh, Lucky Trice.
Lucky Trice.
Yeah.
What about his name?
Lafayette Trice.
Lafayette.
Yeah.
Okay. Was he a native from here, or where did he come from?
He came with a group of black people from down south, most of them, I believe, from shucks. Where did Clinton come from?
Arkansas.
That's it. Arkansas. That's where Lucky came from.
How many other people?
How many? I don't know.
Was it numerous? Like, 30, 40 people, or?
Yeah, I'd say so. Something like that.
Okay.
Just a guess.
Do you remember the year?
No. No.
Okay. Where did this kind of gambling that Lucky Trice was involved in, where did this go on?
In the back room of pool halls.
Were there a lot of pool halls here in La Grande?
Oh, there were several, but not a lot. Was there? He doesn't know. Let me tell you about something that's perhaps a little more interesting. Now, if you go down here and stand by the railroad track for a while, trains will come by. Some of those trains will have a few old boxcars. They're sort of a dirty yellow. And on the side of these cars, there'll be three letters, small letters, not big. There are not many of these cars anymore, but there are some. Those letters are PFE, which means Pacific Fruit Express. And that dates from a time before refrigeration, before Mr. Carrier invented refrigeration, when they shipped the West Coast produce east in boxcars where the temperature was maintained ice. Those letters mean Pacific Fruit Express. Now, where did the ice come from? North Powder, Union Pacific Railroad, caused a number of ponds to be created at North Powder. Water ponds. Not very deep, but covering considerable area. In the wintertime, it gets pretty damn cold down there, and the water freezes. And then the crews hired by Union Pacific cut the ice and transported and put it in these boxcars to cool the fruit. The man in charge of that operation was Herman White. And he comes into this story, not so much, because he was in charge of the ice production, but because one time he took a trip to Portland, and he never came back. He disappeared. They never found him. They don't know what happened. His wife's name was Stellina. Stellina. A good woman, a nice looking woman. And she came up near my, or to my office across from me several times. Probably in connection with her husband's disappearance.
This was about what time, what year, do you remember?
I can't tell you. It was in the 50s and 60s.
Okay.
Well, that's the end of that story. The Mr. Carrier changed the whole business of maintaining cold temperatures. You know the word carrier? You don't.
I don't know the reference.
Carrier was the man that invented things like this here. He invented that. He is the man that made it possible for people to live in Texas. And I'm not exaggerating, because when I was in the military, I was in Texas. And I know how it is. Without air conditioning, it's almost impossible to live there. Well, we could move on to a real story. This story has to do with a farmer out in the valley who evidently felt in need in those old days, this was a long time ago, of a set of double harness for his farming operation. In those days, that's the way you got a horse to move a load. It was with harness, leather harness. So he needed a set of double harness. So he stole a set of double harness.
What's his name?
You're never going to hear that from me. Ever.
Okay.
Ever, ever, ever. These people are still here, some of them. The man is gone. He was my friend. His father was my friend. No way ever. So the story develops. They caught this man that stole the harness. They charged him with grand theft.